KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. In this hour of Forum, as California runs out of cash and grapples with IOUs, it's hard to imagine the state in an age of abundance. But historian Kevin Starr's latest book highlights California in the 1950s, an era when almost anything seemed possible. It was the time of beat poets, cool jazz, Disneyland, unbridled growth, and political leadership that was almost entirely white. The creation of massive freeways also paved the way for some of the problems we now face, like sprawl and traffic congestion. Kevin Starr joins us to examine California from 1950 to 1963, and we'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Michael Krasny. Well, as the state slips deeper into financial chaos, an era when California was the land of milk and honey and almost anything seemed possible is far from our minds. But in his new book, Golden Dreams, California in an Age of Abundance, 1950 to 1963, author and university professor Kevin Starr examines the span of time that brought us Disneyland, the creation of Los Angeles sprawl and West Coast jazz, and the rise of alternative values in places like Big Sur and Marin. And Kevin Starr is with us here to join us to talk about an incredibly vibrant and really ambitious era in California history. Kevin Starr, wasn't it?
Thank you, Scott. Yes, it was. In fact, I had to really fight to compress some of the things that I wanted to put in there. For instance, if you notice, I didn't have really time to develop the art culture because it was a spectacular period in abstract figuratism, moving from abstract expressionism to figuratism, etc. It was a tremendous time in terms of the beginnings of the environmental movement, etc. And I have one chapter on that, the protest against growth. But even within that narrow time, very artificial decade, sort more or less, that I have, there was just so much material. And, of course, being as I am, born 1940, I was encountering a world that informed my own teenage years.
It was very much your era of coming of age, in a sense.
Coming of age as a teenager, high school, of 2 years of college, etc. And I could feel the difference between, say, 1964, 5, 6, with the Vietnam and the assassination of President Kennedy and the free speech movement of Berkeley, all those things that gave the next era, the true 60s, if you will, a different feeling.
Yeah.
So this is basically the 50s, a period, and I think the late, great David Halberstein said that, something to this effect, a period in which there's all the conformity, all the orthodoxy, all the sort of theatrics of the Eisenhower administration, and yet the more we go into that period, we also feel that there's an underlying existential tension that the 60s didn't just come out of nowhere.
Sure, exactly. You had the great jazz happening at that time, the beat poets and all that, they coexisted.
And you had the whole opening to the east, to Zen, especially here in Northern California. You had the beginnings of a relationship to LSD, Aldous Huxley, I go into that, and with the various human potential movements, et cetera, really basically get their start in the late 50s, early 60s.
And, of course, this is coming off it's 5 years after the war. We're in the middle of the Korean War at the beginning of this era. But what fueled this incredible migration of people out to California? Of course, a lot of them did come, or some of them came, to work in at the docks for the war effort. But it continued and accelerated. What brought so many people out here?
Well, if you look, Scott, from the point of view that, say, between 8 to 10 million people passed through the military establishment in World War II, and that if you were in the Navy and the Marine Corps, or if you're being shipped to the Pacific, 1.2 million Army soldiers, sailors, Marines shipped to the Pacific, you were coming through California. You were passing through California. If you were training to be in the Army Air Corps, you were passing through Santa Ana base. I mean, some 22,000 soldiers, sailors, Marines would be on leave on a weekend during the war years. If you were one of those people that sailed out under the Golden Gate Bridge en route to combat in the South Pacific, then California looked like life to you. Looked like the life that was now at risk as you went in harm's way, and you wouldn't be surprised then when you came back. You made it through the war. before. You had the GI bills that you could go on to college or trade school. You had the loans that you could buy a home. That how are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Paris? And so consequently, our population went before the war 6 to up to 9 million, up to 17 million by the more or less by the time I end this book.
And it was by that time the biggest state, or about to become the biggest state in the country.
Yes, I have a chapter called The Biggest State in the Union, because rather than allow myself to make the critique about growth, the losses and gains of growth, it was made very adequately by David Brower, the Sierra Club, the Cry California people. So I have that particular chapter called The Largest State in the Union. Some people welcome that, and many other Californians who really became very active in the environmental movement, Wallace Stegner, David Brower, began to warn and say, now, wait a minute, there's a lot of things that are problematic here.
But it was a time of, the waterways were built, the university expanded, massive freeway construction. To what extent was there political consensus in the state when those decisions got made? Now, there was a movement that pushed back afterwards, but when those decisions were being made, were there criticisms, were there concerns about the cost and the impact?
Exactly, Scott. You talked about the water project. Proposition 1 passed in November 1960. That launched the greatest public works project of its kind in the history of the human race in terms of water engineering, that really engineered the whole state in terms of water resources. That passed by something like 1% of the vote. And Governor Brown, who campaigned for it ceaselessly, went to bed that night, as I relate, thinking that he had lost the election. He woke up in the morning and barely. And even counties up in the north that were the victims of flood control voted against it. The Bay Area was radically against it because they saw it as a Southern California water grab. So we had deep divisions in the culture at this point 50, 60 years ago, but we also had a culture of politics. Don't forget, until 1959, you had Democrats could enter Republican primaries and Republicans could enter Democratic primaries. Consequently, the Republican Party, which was a million less in registration, was forced to the center. And the Democratic Party, in order to get those Republican votes it also needed, because it could get them as well, Governor, or vice versa, Governor Earl Warren in 1946 won both the Republican and the Democratic nomination. So you had a politics of the center. And, you know, today we look back at that period of the good old boys and good old girls up in Sacramento. And I say good old girls, not patronizing it, because we had many good female legislators during this period, like Dorothy Donohoe, the author of our Higher Education Act Bill of 1960. We look back, you know, they drank whiskey at the Torch Club, and they ate Chinese food at Frank Fats, and et cetera. Sometimes they consorted with loose women, et cetera. On the other hand, they knew politics.
And they knew a good compromise when they saw it.
Aristotle defines politics, the art of the possible. They knew what was possible. They said to the members of the Masonic League, Republicans in their double-breasted suits and rimless glasses and big ties, said to the Democrats, hey, you want this, I want that. Let's sit down, let's see what we can work out. And they say, okay, well, and they worked it out. And the governors, all of them, Earl Warren, Goodwin Knight, and Pat Brown, and even later, Ronald Reagan, who is a much more transitional figure, although that's for a later book to talk about that than we think. The governors did politics very effectively with the legislature.
And I'm wondering, you know, you also talk about the rise of more partisan politics. Richard Nixon came of age politically during that era and was known as being, you know, very closely allied with people like Joe McCarthy. Talk about him a little bit as a figure.
He's fascinating, but you have to – everything you just said is true, Scott, but you also have to recognize that some historians are now seeing Nixon as the last New Deal president. When they look at the
moderate.
When they look at the Health Maintenance Organization Act, when they look at the Endangered Species Act, when they look at model cities, when they look at the opening to China, it's kind of hard to fit that idea of the sort of McCarthyite. But I'm not taking away that other side to Nixon. He's a very complex person. And in effect, I think the encounter I dramatized between Earl Warren and Nixon and the 1952 Chicago convention is really this, is the Republican as the centrist, the progressive with a capital P influence, and Nixon coming out of something else that's beginning to be influenced, a kind of Sunbelt-based populist conservatism that's coming into the Republican Party, and with the rise of the Democratic clubs, a much more cutting-edge left liberal, and I'm not taking, as a former state official, I take no positions on these different positions. But so you have a collapse of the center, and it's symbolized in 1958, not only symbolized, but actualized when William Nolan, who is a hard on the hard right, the Republican Party, says to Goodwin Knight, the Republican running for his own second term, who had tremendously strong labor support across the board, no, I'm going to run for governor. You run for the Senate, thereby displacing another liberal Republican, Senator Mayor George Christopher here of San Francisco. At that, with that defeat, with that absolute rout of Nolan by Knight, you have the splitting apart of the kind of centrism that characterized this era, the political culture of centrism.
And, of course, all these people, as we pointed out, mostly men, all of them white. And you write in the book that California entered the 20th century essentially as a Jim Crow state. But by mid-century, California was on the verge of not exactly change, but the beginnings of change.
Beginnings of change. And I look at Jesse Unruh and the Unruh Act. And I also begin to look at...
Tell us a little bit about that, because law is still used.
Absolutely. Well, it was an end run. Usually the scenario of the civil rights movement, you had the tremendous... moral leadership that Dr. King would exercise. You have demonstrations. You have the terrible bombings in the South. And then you move up towards 1964, 65 as a great political movement. In the case of the Unruh Act, you have this brilliant parliamentarian, Jess Unruh, doing an end run. And I emphasize the fact that his staff were Ivy League educated, if you will, not if you will, especially one of them, African Americans with very distinguished role records as combat leaders during World War II. So they, although they weren't public officials in their own right, they were part of this parliamentary consulting team that had Jess Unruh do a parliamentary end run for the Unruh Act. Now, Jess Unruh was from poor, the kind of 1930s people coming into California, Texas, and the Dust Bowl states. He could have gone the other direction in his attitude. He just said, he could have sort of said, I'm not all for these minorities, et cetera, et cetera. And he did not succumb to that temptation. Although he made sure, incidentally, we have to be very clear, he was a very good politician, that he had enough, that his district was gerrymandered enough with the white votes that he had a sort of automatic return to Sacramento.
But that law, that act, did basically establish the basis for equality, for equal rights in
California. And its preamble, which I can't quote from memory, but I can paraphrase, its preamble that we're, in effect, all created equal and that nobody has the right to be denied access to jobs, places, any kind of – that if it's paid for publicly, everybody gets to use it.
Yeah. You write, of course, a fair amount about Los Angeles, which becomes the huge city that we now know or begins to become that way. And there are three figures that you tie together in that chapter. One of them is James Francis Cardinal McIntyre, who was the Archbishop of Los Angeles. He came from New York. The LAPD chief, William Henry Parker, who became close with the producers of Dragnet, that TV show about the LAPD. Dorothy Chandler, the philanthropist and arts patron. All of those folks, along with Walter O'Malley, who brought the LA Dodgers to Los Angeles from Brooklyn. Talk about that, those four folks, and the extent to which they had sort of a synergy in changing Los Angeles.
If you look at Los Angeles as we come into the 40s, into the early 50s, the entertainment industry is flourishing, although it has to adjust to television, et cetera. But there's a tremendous concern in the establishment that Los Angeles wasn't really, or let's just put it more positively, that it was ready for its next phase of civic identity. And San Francisco, and when it came to matters cultural, San Francisco was very much on its mind. Just the way the Los Angeles was very much on San Francisco's mind in the 1930s when we got the Bay Bridge and the Golden Gate Bridge to be built so that we too could expand into our hinterlands. But each of these figures, Cardinal McIntyre, the first Roman Catholic prelate to be named to the College of Cardinals in the West, And that itself signifies a kind of rise of a population. He was the chief administrator of New York, where you had a long established, highly developed Catholic culture. And he had come up, he had entered the priesthood later. His early career was on Wall Street and financial services, etc. And so he came and he built. He built schools, hundreds of schools. He built hundreds of churches, hospitals, etc. So you have the building up of the fabric there. Now, I ally that with also what was going on with Protestant churches, with synagogues, because religious worship became one of the religious communities became one of the ways that millions of people from elsewhere reconvened in Southern California when they suddenly found, well, okay, I'm going to join the local synagogue, I'm joining St. Brendan's Church, etc., and that was very powerful. In the case of William Parker, you had an implicit covenant right from the 1920s between the people of Los Angeles and the LAPD. And it was kind of like the current thing, don't ask, don't tell. In other words, the Los Angeles was growing at such a rate, people from elsewhere, many of them marginal, many of them given to misbehavior, that in the 1920s, a sort of implicit autonomy began to move into the LAPD. And, I mean, that's a staple of, isn't it, of so many mystery stories and films, et cetera, the kind of tough-talking LAPD detective who's a law and
Raymond
himself.
Chandler.
Raymond Chandler, exactly. Parker wanted to professionalize that. And he's a very complex man. Very few people of us are just, you know, unfortunately, Parker had a way of saying provocative right-wing things, so they survive is the only thing about him. But he also wanted to bring the department up into modern standards. He wanted to keep the mob out from the East Coast. I mean, this was a very lucrative possibilities of organizing the city, etc. Dorothy Chandler was concerned about performing arts culture. Performing arts culture, and implicitly performing arts culture, brought the entertainment community, which was not exclusively but significantly Jewish, together with the downtown establishment, which was not exclusively but significantly Anglo-American Protestant. And sort of she welded together those two Los Angeleses and brought them forward. And the case of Walter O'Malley, as the Mayor Poulsen said at the time, L.A. is big time in everything except baseball. And the negotiation between the Dodgers and Los Angeles, and between I focus in on urbanism, where O'Malley's wanted to stay in Brooklyn, but Robert Moses wanted him to build out in Flatbush, and so you really have a debate about urbanism, in as much as big league baseball signifies coming of age as a city. So these people left Los Angeles very different from when they found it, and they did most of their business during these decades. The next chapter after that is called Dividends and Losses and Dividends, Los Angeles is a super city. Okay, once it becomes the super city, what's it gain, what's it lose?
Right. And that year that the Dodgers came out here, 1958, of course, was also a great year for San Francisco. The Giants came as well, Willie Mays. And
well, the two movements are very linked together.
Yeah, but very different.
Very different.
And much less controversial bringing the Giants here.
Absolutely. Well, because they said about the tablets. They said that O'Malley had the tablets, the stone tablets like Moses brought down from Sinai, all the things he was demanding that you had to give him. And there was an election, and it was reasonably close in Los Angeles to approve the whole package that was offered to the Dodgers.
As you point out, the university system grew, or plans to build it were expanded during that era. Clark Kerr, the president of UC, three campuses either built or planned at San Diego, Irvine, and Santa Cruz. I'm wondering, were all these things, to what extent was paying for all these things an issue?
No, I can't say that there wasn't debate, but I do not find significant debate about paying for them. Because in the previous period, say in the 1940s, Republicans and Democrats alike all want – we don't have the California State University campus. We have state college campuses. They all wanted college campuses there. In 1944, Santa Barbara leveraged because of the political influence of Santa Barbara, leveraged its state college into the UC system. And you had the rise of the previous rise of the 20s and 30s, San Diego State and Chico State from the 1880s, San Jose. So this was a bipartisan kind of movement for Republican and Democrats alike. Plus the Donahue Act, Higher Education Act, negotiated a four-part, not just three-part, but a four-part relationship. And the University of California, the newly established State College, soon to be California State University, and the community colleges. Today, I think there's some – every time I memorize how many community colleges we have, I find that I'm about 25 off. And also the private sector then through Cal Grants and through the private sector is the fourth leg on the stool.
To what extent was all of that expansion, the roads, the waterways, the schools, to what extent was it responsible for the growth that occurred and versus accommodating the growth that was already here and well underway?
Well, Scott, you have gone right to the core of the opponents of growth, as I develop in my chapter, the opponents of growth point of view. They looked, for instance, and they said, now, wait a minute. The water department is laying down plans to have water services for 80,000 people in Half Moon Bay by 2016 or something.
Some far-off date.
That's all. In fact, they call them water hustlers, that you build the water to serve the population, and then the water you build quadruples the population that you intended to serve. And, yes, there is – if you look at the plans that came out, in 1947, of course, the gasoline tax, but 1957, the freeway plan – in 1960, the passing of the California State Water Plan and also the Higher Education Act in 1960, you really have the setting up of a extraordinary infrastructure of California as mega state, as global mega state. In fact, to this day, we're living off that infrastructure. We're living off the momentum of that infrastructure. I remember when I...
Much of which is crumbling, you might say.
Well, it's 50, 60 years old now. I remember when I worked for three governors as state librarian, Pete Wilson, Gray Davis, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Remember Governor Gray Davis dedicated an extension of a small extension of a freeway down in Southern California, and he said in his speech, this is probably the last freeway we're going to build. And he's looking back at an epic of freeway construction that starts in 1939-40 with the Arroyo Seco. So, and that educational infrastructure brings people here for education. It also provides technocratically educated elites to move into Cold War campus. That's why I call that chapter Cold War Campus. Defense spending is incredible. Scott, by the late, about 57, 58, defense spending in Los Angeles County was so powerful, so pervasive, that they even had sheltered workshops where handicapped people could work assembling structures, defense missile structures, etc. In other words, you had, in effect, Americans with Disability Act kind of sensibility. That was not passed yet. Coming in even to the defense industry to give you a sense of how pervasive all that was.
Based on the demand.
And yes. And then these think tanks like RAND, like Hughes Aircraft, like the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. These are think tanks that are in dialogue with universities, Livermore Lab in Berkeley, in which everything from the conquest of space, which or coming to the moon, which of course does occur in President Kennedy's time, to the possibilities of thermonuclear exchange, et cetera. All this is being worked out, thought out, calculated here
Some of it just sort of happening as well. It wasn't all planned. Kevin Starr is going to be with us for the rest of the hour. We'd love to have you join us. The number to call here, 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. And as always, you can email us. It's forum@kqed.org. His new book is called Golden Dreams, California in an Age of Abundance, 1950 to 1963. By the way, he'll be giving a talk and signing books tonight at the California Historical Society on Mission Street. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here this week for Michael Krasny. And my guest this hour is Kevin Starr, California State Librarian Emeritus, University Professor of History at the University of Southern California, and prodigious author, I might say. His latest book in a series on Americans and the California Dream is called Golden Dreams, California in an Age of Abundance, 1950 to 1963. And We would love to have you join us. Let me give the phone number out again. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. And Kevin Starr, how did you imagine when you wrote that first book that you would now have written eight in this series? And you have a couple more, at least a couple more left, I think.
Well, no, I didn't. Scott, I was at Harvard doing my PhD in American Literature, American Studies, History of American Civilization. I was a tutor in history and literature there. I finished my orals. What to do for your PhD thesis? That's a big decision. Was it Sartre says we make our decisions and they harden behind us? So I was browsing on the fourth floor of Widener Library. I had loved Van Wyck Brooks's Makers and Finders series. I love Vernon Parrington, Main Currents in American Thought, and books that dealt with the sort of inner imaginative life of social development, aspects of social development. So I was browsing for a topic on the fourth floor. I went through the Harvard California collection, which is just absolutely tremendous. It's a marvelous collection. And
were you from California?
I'm a fourth generation San Franciscan.
Okay.
My great grandfather came here in the early 1850s. So, and then my other great grandfather came from Rhode Island 20 years later. I said to myself, these are wonderful books about California, but with the exception of Franklin Walker's Literary History of California, and then I went to Josiah Royce's Marvelous History of California from the 1880s, I said, there's a whole other story to tell here. I'll do it in one volume. I'll do it in 1850, 1915. So I did that for my PhD thesis. Oxford picked it up. It did very well. Then Sheldon Meyer, the editor at Oxford, said, "Now, then I also went to library after my PhD. I went to library school here at Berkeley. I was librarian at San Francisco for about 4 years. Sheldon Meyer at Oxford said, "Now, Kevin, we got a series here. Why don't you just do the second one?" I said, "Okay." So I did the second one. I got a Guggenheim and I did the Inventing the Dream. And then Sheldon said, "Let's do the next." And lo and behold, Sheldon passed on this time before this one was done. But he edited about half of it, and then I had a marvelous other editor. So lo and behold, I look here with at all these titles inside, and there's eight volumes. It's a I, who was a ambitious 26-year-old graduate student looking for a PhD dissertation, have become a portly grandfather of seven. So time has gone by.
The decision has hardened behind you. All right, let's go to the phones. Again, 866-733-6786 is the number to call. And Peter is on the line in Berkeley. Hi, Peter. Peter, is there?
Good morning.
There you are. Hello, good morning.
Hello. Yeah, good morning. You've reached Frederick in Calistoga.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, hello
very
there.
Very good.
Hi, Frederick.
It's good to be on the phone with you. I have a question regarding how we had ended up paying for this age of abundance. I'd like to tie the question to today's problems. I feel that we had a much higher progressive income tax rate at that time, didn't we? I think that the income tax rate may have been as high as 70% on the wealthiest Californians. And our capital gains rate was much higher. Today, wealthy people pay the same that we all pay. High income tax rate is 35%. Capital gains tax rate is down as low as 15%. It seems that we had paid for this age of abundance in California with a much higher tax rate. And it seems simple. That's the way that we need to go today. Would you concur?
Mr. Kevin Starr.
Well, I know that from my interviewing of Treasurer Bill Lockyer and other people at the State Treasurer's office, et cetera, and I'm not being partisan politics here, I know that the margins of being able to pay for the public culture are not that great. I mean, they're not in terms of our total gross national product as the eighth largest economy in the nation. However, being a nation state with the eighth largest economy in the world. However, we don't have consensus or enough consensus as to the broad-based programs we could have. In other words, a sensibility engendered by the New Deal, even though the New Deal came late to California, not till 1938 with Culbert Olson, there wasn't any effort to roll back the New Deal. And I made the point earlier that even someone whom we see today as on the right, Richard Nixon, had so many New Deal aspects to him. Even Ronald Reagan had a picture of FDR and had a Democratic legislature and signed the largest tax increase to pay for government He's supposed to have been the figure who dismantled it, but it's not the case in California history. So everything you say is correct, but the deeper underlying point is that you had consensus to the center and a willingness to negotiate the center, and the center being the public sector of California. Do we want 220 state parks? Well, Republicans and Democrats at that time said yes. So let's acquire them and set them up.
But couldn't you also say that this era, to a certain extent, set in place the ultimate, the revolt, the Prop 13 revolt that happened a few years later in 1978?
Well, absolutely. And I think that's our the man who just called in emphasized that fact, that it was that by the time of 13, paying for all this, there was a group that said we don't assent to it. And it was a significant group. And perhaps since 1913, since Proposition 13, and Peter Schrag has written on this, that we really haven't renegotiated the center yet for California. They use the phrase "kick the can." We've kicked the can down the road, but we haven't renegotiated the center. You don't find Ronald Reagan making a big pullback of any heroic magnitude. You don't. Jerry Brown, certainly not, although he combined very—
Had elements of austerity.
He had elements of austerity. He had sort of a complex, which I understand given the fact I went to educated by the Jesuits as well, complex point of view on these things. Governor Duke Majan although he was personally a conservative person, didn't try and set up a huge rollback. Whereas today, you do have a group that's small but powerful enough to say it's too big, we don't want to pay for it. I think, Scott, to a certain extent, as equal to tax structures, is generational. There are some people who came into California, came of age in California during the period I chronicle, in which the world was before us, where to choose, as Milton ends Paradise Lost. And today the world is not before us. The global economy is here. We have a complex culture. So what's underneath all this confusion, perhaps the great debate on the New Deal is finally at last surfacing with us.
Yeah. And, of course, you talk about the power of Republicans in the legislature, as we're seeing now. It seems like we won't be able to get to a point where those changes may happen without also changing the part of the Prop 13 that requires a two-thirds vote to get a budget passed.
Well, those Republicans were different Republicans. They were Republicans out of the progressive movement. Some of them had a little touch of the Southwest anti-populist, conservative, anti-government rhetoric. But the Republicans in my period they knew they were elected in significant measure by Democratic votes, and they were centrist. Look at Goodwin Knight. Goodwin Knight was a solid Republican, but as a young man, he had worked as a lead miner, a hard rock miner in Nevada, putting himself through Stanford University, and was very proud of the union support he had as a Republican governor. Same thing with Earl Warren.
Let's go back to the phones. And again, the number 866-733-6786. And now we go to Peter in Berkeley. Hi, Peter.
There we go. how are you?
Good.
Hey, listen, I wanted to tap the expertise and profound knowledge of Mr. Starr about the development and breakthroughs in the library system, public and university libraries, interlibrary cooperation, comments from your personal career, some of the things you're most proud of, and citizen participation and history and all of that.
Well, thank you, Peter, for saying that. I think our library system in California we can trace it back to the Hispanic era. In 1845, 44, 45, the Californio community of Los Angeles set up a public library. Or we can trace it back to the pre-statehood era when Samuel Hopkins Wiley, a Dartmouth-educated minister, set up the first public library in the American period in Monterey. Or we can trace it to the extraordinary early founding of the San Francisco Public Library in the 1870s. Even earlier than that, the Mechanics Library here in the 1850s, the Los Angeles Public Library System in the 70s, and San Francisco in the 70s. And then the Public Library Acts of the early 1900s, which in effect said nobody, even the most rural person, even the most remotely located person, is going to be denied access to library service. And the state library set that system up. And then, of course, in my own time, we had the passage of the Library of California Act, which said that, in effect, our goal is to establish a circulating system throughout the entire state. Now, we had already begun to do that. And that's one thing. And now you ask me what I'm proudest of. I'm proudest because my father lost his eyesight, had a brain tumor. I'm very proud of the Kevin Starr Access Act. The blind community named it after me. We worked for 8 years to get the technology to get a digital equipment that you could, blind people could, registering through their local library, could dial up and get up to 5 to 6 newspapers where the digital feed would go into a voice. You could even dial a Spanish accent or a male accent or female accent. And all the voices is slightly robotic. It's not completely robotic. It's a rather nice voice. And we got that system set up during the Schwarzenegger administration. In fact, there was $1 million that we needed to pay for the administrative setup of the system. It was cut out of Governor Schwarzenegger's first budget. And when I was interviewed by the Sacramento Bee, I said, oh, no, that's some local bureaucrat who did that. The governor won't let that happen. And lo and behold, I went home that night and I had a call 310-something. So I called down 310 and it was the governor. And he said, hello. When I heard the voice, I said, somebody's either putting me on or it's the governor. He said, what's going on here? I don't want to stop this program. And why don't you tell me about this? I said, governor, there's about 26 degrees of separation between us. But he put $1 million back and that program got in. And I'm very proud of that because I became very fond of so many of our 500,000 blind and visually handicapped Californians during my time as state librarian.
Peter, thanks for the call. And, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger came into office saying he wanted to be another Pat Brown, talking about all the things you write about in this book and the incredible vision that he had and the ability to pay for it. And, of course, that really has gone nowhere in California.
That's the conundrum of our times. I didn't know where we would be when I started this book 5 years ago. Because when I was in state government for 10 years, we recovered. I mean, I came in with Pete Wilson. He appointed me state librarian. Although I'm a Democrat, he appointed me beyond partisan politics. He was faced with a 40% drop-off in revenues when the Cold War collapsed. He left office with a surplus.
And signed a big tax increase, too.
Yes, he did. Well, on the other hand, when he left, he gave a reception, and I was at the reception, and I said, Governor Wilson, in your current budget, you've spent more on libraries statewide than any governor in the history of this state. And he said, well, thank you for telling me that. I said, well, we didn't want to have a big empty shelves empty shelves saying, well, what's that? Well, that was the Wilson administration. So he gave us money for textbooks, for schools, rural schools, all kinds of wonderful programs.
Another somewhat moderate Republican.
Yes, exactly, out of the older Republican gestalt.
866-733-6786 is the number if you'd like to speak with Kevin Starr here. And let's go now to Dayton, Ohio. Chris is on the line. Hi, Dayton. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I was just wondering, I am an over-the-road driver, and I have had the fortune or misfortune, depending on the day, of traveling the interstate highways all across the country. And I'm just wondering, how large of a price are we going to be paying for the neglect that the last 50 years have seen on our infrastructure, not just our highways, but also our water system and other large works projects? Because every year, more and more roads get worse, despite seeing road crews out. And I've got to say, unfortunately, L.A. is one of the worst.
Well, and, yeah, go ahead, Kevin. So I was going to say, you know, you build something that big, then you got to maintain it.
Absolutely. Chris, I'm just finishing a small little book on the Golden Gate Bridge, the construction of the Golden Gate Bridge during the Depression. And when it dawned on everybody that this bridge, the minute you finish building it, you have to continue to build it for the last 50 to 60 years. And that's the same with we know that with complex works of engineering, but it's the same thing in your home. And as you say, that great interstate highway system established during the Eisenhower administration during the mid-50s and constructed over the next 20 years, and the ancillary road systems, et cetera, demand maintenance. Demand that people be willing to tax themselves through the political process for these funds, and that there be systematic maintenance of the built environment.
You know, a lot of the book focuses on development that occurred in California during this era, and awful lot of people must have gotten awfully rich off of these things, thinking ahead to the impact of rezoning and water and how the bringing of water, changing water patterns is going to present opportunities for housing and all kinds of other things. Who are some of the people in that era that really, really made off?
Well, I think it starts before the war is over. 1944, Fritz Burns in Southern California, and David Bohannon up here in Northern California. These are two developers. David Bohannon did San Leandro just in the late 30s. He did Hillsdale Garden Apartments. They're put on a panel by Governor Warren on post-war housing needs of California. And they issue a report, which I cite. I read that. I mean, that's a wonderful thing when I was state librarian on my own time, not on the taxpayers' time. At least I didn't have to go very far to get these beautiful documents. And so that it was apparent there what had to be built, what was going to be built. And already by 1944, Henry J. Kaiser gets into a partnership with Fritz Burns, and they had developed the techniques. If you can build a Liberty ship in a 24-hour sequence, if you can standardize construction, et cetera, for a complex thing as an airplane, in which over 200,000 parts have to flow together without computer tracking, all tracked on 3x5 cards, then that technology, not just here in California, but in Levittown also in Long Island, that technology can be aimed towards mass production of housing. So I would say that Henry J. Kaiser and Fritz Burns are among the first to go in. One of my favorites is Joseph Eichler, and a Bay Area developer. And he does not develop the overwhelming amount of homes, about 10,000 homes up here in the Bay Area and some in Southern California. But he really shows that mass construction techniques, putting all your public utilities in one corridor, laying down a concrete frame, et cetera, those mass construction are not inimical to distinguished architecture. And today, an Eichler home that cost just a few thousand dollars in the 1950s is worth well over $1 million and plus.
Well, and you pointed out in the book that Joseph Eichler was something of an iconoclast, not just in terms of design, but also in terms of who he hired to build his homes and who he sold his homes to.
So one time a person came in and Chris wanted to buy an Eichler home, and Eichler was there himself. He was a Burlingame-based businessman before the war, and he got into housing a little later. And he was an interesting combination of left wing, right wing in his attitudes. But he certainly, this person complained, well, I hope you make sure that there's no African American or Negro people, black people. And Eichler said, get out of here. I won't sell to you. Get out of my office.
And at that time, there were many restrictive covenants.
The restrictive covenant was the technique in which California was kept a Jim Crow state without having to have sort of signs in the bus station saying for colored only and certain water fountains, et cetera. Those signs were all buried in the language of real estate development.
And was Eichler, did he pay a price for that?
No, he was just too, he was too tough, too good, and his product was too spectacular. Plus, he knew his market. He knew where he was going. Eichler was aiming towards those who basically had a certain level of education, not necessarily overly affluent, and had a taste for high modernism. And in fact, you walk into those Eichler homes today, and you feel really the birth of the cool. They're cool.
They're
very 50s.
Lots of light and windows.
And you feel that you're in a world that's being reinvented right in front of you.
Yeah. Back to the phones now. Eric is on the line in San Francisco. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
I heard Mr. Starr say that Jim Crow, was pretty much over by the 1950s.
No.
But we've had the Watts riots and the Rodney King riots.
Right. He can speak for himself. But I think he said that the change was beginning.
No, I didn't say it was over. Far from it. It's the beginning of the end. In fact, it's the bare minimal beginning of the end. In the
beginning
50s.└
of the beginning.
It's the beginning of the beginning. I do not say it's over. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, even in the the KQED neighborhood series, it was mentioned several times that no black people, gay men or women, were allowed to live in the Castro until the early, 2001, 2003.
Oh, absolutely. That's why my chapter is very tentative. I just say at the conclusion of the chapter, it's only the beachhead. It's the first landing. And it's not even a landing in force, but it's a landing nevertheless.
And there are still many parts of California that are fairly segregate?
Well, today segregation is much more subtle. It's based on class, on income, the whole rise of the gated community, which is not a phenomenon during this period, although you, like everything else, you can come across certain beginnings of it. But the whole gated community phenomenon, et cetera, of development in the 70s and 80s in Southern California especially is ahead. It's outside the ken of this book.
All right, Eric, thanks so much for the call. Cynthia is next in Oakland. Hi, Cynthia.
Thank you. Fascinating program. And I'm wondering if Dr. Starr would comment on how do we rebuild a consensus. And I didn't think that Arnold was ever put in by wanting to. I thought he was put in by sort of small interests of, and he certainly isn't responding on the budget for sure. So I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Well, I have to refer back to, I don't want to judge Governor Schwarzenegger. I worked for him, and he was a delight to work for, and I continued to do some consulting with him occasionally when he needs it. I remember his second inaugural address when he talks about getting into a post-partisan era. And I don't think it's the governor's intention. I don't think he wakes up in the morning saying, oh, I want to cut $3 billion from schools. In fact, as Mr. Schaefer suggested, it was the exact opposite of what he wanted to do. He's married to a Kennedy. He's married to a liberal Democrat. He represents really not a throwback, but at least a reappearance of that older kind of Republicanism. On the other hand, you just have a breakdown of consensus. It's not Governor Schwarzenegger who's failing to pass the budget or to negotiate a public center. There's two, in this case, three branches of government, but there's two directly applicable. So I don't. I think it'd be very hard. Don't forget, the governor was raised in Austria, and everything in Austria is way to the left of anything we have here.
It's all government.
Exactly, in terms of European style. And again, I don't want to get too grandiloquent on this, but he's also formed by his Catholic faith, which is has a social gospel message to it. He didn't set out to do these things. In fact, the University of California, if you notice, is very quiet on these issues until recently, because when the state government ran out of money initially during Governor Schwarzenegger's time, he said to the University of California, listen, hold it, I'll take care of you. And then a couple years later, he did. But right now, the thing is an absolute mess on all sides. That's why I don't want to question the motives of anybody on this issue. I mean, this is a conundrum, an impasse. I don't think they're good guys or bad guys. I think there's just a real dilemma here that's cultural and generational.
I want to ask you, we're a little short on time, got a few minutes left. You've written about all these different eras in California history. You're a fourth generation San Franciscan. If there were an era in California that you could go back and live in, what would it be?
Today, right now.
Really?
1st of July, 2009. I don't have a sentimental view of the past. Huh? If I was an African-American person back here in this 50s period, or if I was a woman interested in a career, equal rights in an office and going to law school and becoming a partner in my firm or whatever, et cetera, I'm not or a real estate or a minority person wanting to buy a home in a suburb. I'm with all our problems, et cetera, there is today in California, still, it is a global commonwealth. It's an ecumenical commonwealth. Not everybody gets along all the time, but there's never been a historic experiment of this many people brought together in one polity under the protection of the Constitution of the United States, the Constitution of the State of California. And we're going to muddle through this thing. We're going to see it through. I don't believe inevitably in progress. I think certain things had high points. For instance, architecture had a high point at this time, domestic architecture. On the other hand, I've been seeing some very beautiful things designed lately by some wonderful younger architects. So I wake up every day just delighted to be here and feeling a sense of the past and reminding myself what the great California-born Harvard philosopher Josiah Roy said when he wrote his book on California. I'm paraphrasing very quickly. And the fact that California is not the unearned increment. It's not something you're given. It's something you struggle for.
Maybe another way of looking at it, though, is there a person you've written about? You mentioned Joseph Eichler in terms of housing.
In the current book?
So, yeah, well, someone that you'd suggest would love to have coffee with him or drinks with him sometime.
Well, I did know a lot of these people because they were still alive when I was librarian of the city in the early to mid 1970s. But who would I like to be? Well, I'd like to be with Mr. Eichler. He liked cigars. I'd like to get a sense of what he I liked all those people. I worked. I was an executive assistant to Joe Alioto, who makes a cameo appearance as a rising figure in San Francisco life. I think the person who's influenced me most are two very disparate people, and that's Josiah Royce and Isadora Duncan. Two San Francisco people, Josiah Royce, in terms of loyalty to your province, systematic development of California materials, etc., and Isadora Duncan as a young girl of 16 down at the shore dancing to the waves and recreating on her own the sort of dance of ancient Greece. What tremendous courage. And then going back to Augustine Daly's theater in Chicago saying, here I am, 16 years old, I've discovered the dance of the ancient Greeks, et cetera. I think there's something wonderful in that. I admire also Carrie McWilliams, the historian and social activist, et cetera. On the other hand, I'm bipartisan too. I like all those wonderful liberal and moderate and centrist Republicans in the 1950s who did such a great job for the state.
Real quickly, how concerned are you that kids today, to use a phrase, aren't learning history, don't care about history, or aren't being taught history in a way that really captivates them?
Well, that's up to their teachers to make history interesting. Now, I don't want to be chauvinistic, but I will. But we at the University of Southern California Department of History have no problem motivating our students to like history.
Yeah.
Because we say, look, in a few short years, you're going to be making history. So let's see what your previous generations have done.
All right. Kevin Starr, his new book is called Golden Dreams, California in an Age of Abundance, 1950 to 1963. And as I mentioned earlier, he'll be doing a reading and also signing books tonight at the California Historical Society on Mission Street, right near 3rd down there. Near the MoMA. Thanks so much for having you, Dr. Starr. Always a pleasure to chat.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer.
Forum is produced by Tina Lauerberg, Judy Campbell, and Kevin Guillory. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman. I'm Scott Schaefer in for Michael Krasny. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.